Hi, my name is Amanda Hale. I'm presenting a series of podcasts, outtakes from my new novel, Mad Hatter. This is podcast number 3, The Armadillo. I'm finding lately that everything I have believed in and had passion for is slowly losing meaning. Is this a result of aging, or of our new global situation, or both? Perhaps it is simply a response to our changing modus operandi. This is how it started, mid-March, as COVID took hold. I had built up the usual head of steam needed for launching a book, with months of promotional book events confirmed, and then, as they were cancelled or postponed, I began to realize how stupid all that activity had been. I had a new perspective, a vision of billions of ants swarming on an anthill, slowly turning in space, illuminating and darkening itself every 24 hours. Canadian writer Margaret Lawrence once wrote something to the effect of, "When there is no future, we fall back on the glow of the past." In writing my latest novel, Mad Hatter, this is more or less what I have done. I retraced my steps to examine a past that, though it was in fact far from glowing, had for me that fascination that all our childhood memories have, with clues to what had formed me, and secrets that had denied me full access to who I might become. A fictionalized story based on the life of my own family, Mad Hatter is dense with childhood memory and feeling, but with the benefit of adult retrospect. Visual artists have retrospective exhibitions. As a writer, this is mine. It is the story that has been ripening inside me all my life, awaiting its moment. You could say it's a memoir, but it's not. It's a fiction. Having dealt with memory in much of my writing, I understand how we invent, embellish, select, and censor in order to make sense of our lives in the form of story. My podcasts each focus on a particular theme or aspect of Mad Hatter, and today I want to talk about Nancy Brooke, my paternal grandmother. She was in my life for 26 years, right up till my wedding day in April 1970. That was the last time I saw her. She was already well into her 90s and had embroidered an ivory satin cushion with the names of my husband and I for us to kneel on during our wedding service. I no longer have it. I tossed it out along with so many other babies with the bathwater. That cushion was emblematic of Granny, a woman who made beautiful things to show her caring. I don't regret discarding the cushion. I have the memory of it. Another memory, a vivid one, that returns and returns to me, is of a day I spent with Granny when I was a child. My mother was always dropping me off somewhere, while she rushed around on errands for her own parents, or visiting my siblings at their various boarding schools. Nancy Brooke was not sent to an old people's home, like my maternal great-grandmother and her sister, Maud Middlewood, who I spoke of in my last podcast. After she was widowed, Nancy continued to live in her own home, with a housekeeper cook to attend to her domestic needs. She was a keen gardener. She had a grand piano in her living room and had taught my father to play, though I never heard her play. Nancy had trained in her youth as a fashion designer and was skilled both as an artist and as a seamstress. On our day together, she sketched me as I sat very still in the big armchair opposite her, one on either side of the fireplace. I was fascinated by the armadillo shell on the hearth. Granny let me touch it and laughed at my hesitation to pick it up. "It won't bite," she joked. The armadillo was big in my small hands, and I couldn't help but see it as a live thing, curled and armored against people like me who wanted to interfere with it. The armadillo was preserved in such a way that it lay on its curved back, an empty shell, its tail curled, its head armor in place, but there was no head, no eyes or ears, no nose or mouth, no body to fill the shell. Nevertheless, its form gave it life. It lived on the hearth, where fireplace tools were placed inside its shell, coal tongs, wooden spills to light the fire, and a brush to sweep up the ashes. I hadn't dared to touch it before, but now that I was alone with Granny, I had permission. And after that day, I always visited the armadillo as though it was my friend in that house, where I was just a child, always in the way between my mother and her socializing. I was silent and armoured, like the armadillo, to be seen and not heard, eviscerated to all appearances. And Granny, too, was rather like the armadillo, I realized as time went on. She was there, but not quite there, a smiling presence wrapped in layers of protective covering, soft fabrics, powders and perfumes, a tiny hairpiece of waves at her brow where the hair had receded. She had two hairpieces, one to wear while the other was being washed and waved at the hairdresser. Granny was smooth and predictable, unchanging, like a butterfly pinned to prevent its escape. We had a glass-fronted wooden case in our house filled with a display of pinned butterflies. Someone in our family collected them, probably one of the uncles on my mother's side, where all the men were fox hunters and pheasant shooters. Writing from extreme adulthood about childhood experience makes me realize how our perceptions change and evolve over a lifetime. It's comparable to a long, slow process of digestion. My mother was plagued with indigestion during my childhood. Those of you who have read Mad Hatter will understand why. Her life became extremely difficult with my father's wartime internment, and even worse when he was released. I, too, suffered chronic indigestion during my 7 years of marriage. The body speaks. If we cannot digest our lives, the body rebels, trying to tell us to make a change. I also had eczema and another skin disease called pityriasis rosea, with scaly red circles climbing up my legs. My perception of Nancy Battersby, named Nancy Brooke in Mad Hatter, has evolved over the years from unquestioning childhood acceptance to conformity with family opinion. She's so good. Isn't Granny marvelous? Such a lady, were typical remarks. In other words, as I came to understand with the development of my own judgment, a passive, smiling cipher of a woman who never uttered an unkind word or strong opinion, never rocked the boat, was bound by habit and the fulfillment of a rigid schedule. Granny was for us children a safe person, always the same, agreeable, unchallenging, and as I later realized, completely inaccessible. If you reached in, you would find nothing but a void. She was, like the armadillo, an empty shell. Very strong, armored with routine, protected from the world. Later, I developed some compassion and understanding as I learned that Nancy had been born with a twin brother who had died as an infant. Her mother had died a year or two later, and she was brought up by a strict Victorian father who took her on long, brisk walks every day, in all weathers, until a rather cold stepmother came on the scene. Clearly, Nancy's survival skills had been established very early. In writing about other people, one learns about oneself. I neglected Granny during my teenage years and 20s. She was old. She ceased to exist. During my 30s and 40s, she re-emerged into memory and was judged for her artifice, her ineffectuality, her inability to take a stand, all the things I was then battling in myself. I hesitated to dwell on Nancy Brooke in writing Mad Hatter because I felt so negative and bluntly judgmental about her. But as I wrote her character, a transformation occurred. When you write, you have to become each character. Act them out, speak their lines, walk in their shoes. This is where compassion arose, an appreciation of all the things that Granny was instead of judgment of what she was not. We're not on this earth to be perfect. We're here to survive as best we can and to learn. For many, as in the case with Margaret Lawrence's Stone Angel character, Hagar Shipley, the analysis and realization come late, on the deathbed. No doubt I too will have more revelations on that day. Now I'd like to read for you a couple of excerpts from Mad Hatter featuring Nancy Brooke. The first one is from Chapter 1 of Part 3, and it's about writing a check. Nancy Brooke has never understood finances. Since her husband's death, she's had to learn how to write a check. She has placed her financial affairs in the hands of the National Westminster Bank, in whom she has confidence. Each quarter, a man with a briefcase visits her, a Mr. Trimble, and talks at length about money matters. She smiles politely and pays no attention to what he is saying. It is not within her realm. She is grateful that there are men who spend their days taking care of such matters, but she has no wish to know about it. She offers the neatly dressed, well-groomed gentleman a glass of sweet sherry and joins him, taking tiny sips from her own glass. She remembers when the craze for cocktail cigarettes came in and all the women began smoking at dinner parties. She would take one of her favourite pink gold-tipped Russian Sobranis, dip it in creme de menthe and suck on the tip. She had no interest in smoking. It was simply a game she played. Dissembling. Always dissembling. It was required of one. Nancy is surprised when Mrs. Ward ushers Christopher into the drawing room. She notices that he looks rather pale and has an air of the traveller about him since his return from Australia, as though he cannot settle, having been in motion so long. His petition for financial help takes her by renewed surprise. "But what about your inheritance, dear?" He explains at length something about investments, money tied up, a temporary loan. Of course she must help him. He is her son. And he has never asked before. If James were alive, he would surely make the same decision. Nancy glides across the room to her writing desk, where she settles herself for the ceremonial task of writing a cheque. This important act of signing away money disturbs the flock of butterflies that reside in her tummy, their wings brightly coloured like her pink Sobranis. Her fingers tremble slightly as she grips the fountain pen and watches the blue ink flow into the wetness of her signature. £100, to be returned within 6 months, with interest. They are Christopher's words, dictated to her, the scribe. This is the language of men, abstract, numerical, dense with hidden meaning. She does not know what interest means. What the concept behind it is, something, she thinks vaguely, to do with Shylock, the Merchant of Venice, the cutting of flesh. The butterflies cluster below her corset. She supposes that word gives importance to the matter, a matter of interest to all concerned, an engagement. She records the transaction carefully in the ledger supplied to her by Mr. Trimble, and with a flourish she lays down her pen, neatly capped, turns to Christopher and hands him the little piece of paper. For a moment she has felt important, though out of her depth, and now she returns to her familiar role, giving Christopher a motherly smile. Now I'll read another fragment about Granny's housekeeper, a Miss Thorpe, who came to work for her after Mrs. Ward hung up her apron and retired to live in Grimsby with her maiden sister. Miss Thorpe has turned out to be quite unsuitable, and despite her begging for another chance, has been given notice. It was a Saturday, exactly 1 month after Dick Blackwell's funeral, when Cynthia and Katie drew up at the Haven at 11 o'clock, as planned. Nancy opened the door to them herself and explained that the housekeeper was upstairs packing her belongings. She was to leave the next day. "I'll be without help until Monday morning," she said. "Katie and I could stay with you tomorrow night," Cynthia offered. "Oh, no, dear. I expect I'll manage." She had invited them for lunch in Manchester at Kendall Milnes. It was to be an outing with perhaps a little shopping, something to lift Cynthia's spirits after all that she'd been through. It was a long day. The traffic was bad, and Katie had to sit in the back when she got car sick, so they had to stop at the side of the road while the child vomited, her face chalky and damp. When they returned to Nancy Brooke's house, it was exactly 4 o'clock. "Will you come in for a cup of tea?" "Thank you, Granny, but we have to get back. I'll see you to the door with your parcels. Get in the front, Katie, and don't move till I come back." They walked up the pathway, and Nancy opened the door with her own keys, not wanting to disturb Miss Thorpe in her packing. As soon as the door opened, Cynthia smelled it. "What's that?" She sniffed and made a face. "There must be a gas leak." Nancy seemed confused. "I don't know, dear. Where would that be coming from?" "Wait here, Granny, I'll check." As she opened the kitchen door, she immediately clamped her hand over her mouth. She knew then what she would find as she wrapped her scarf around nose and mouth and turned the corner into the scullery. The first thing she saw was the woman's legs, splayed apart on the floor, as though removed from her body. She didn't want to enter that galley. She didn't want to look at the bloated face. But she had to turn the gas off and see if she was still alive. After she'd opened the back door and all the windows, letting the cold January air rush through the house, she dialed 999 and asked for the police. "There's been a suicide," she said, "at 93 Mayfield Road. Yes, yes, dead. Quite cold." She found Nancy Brooks standing in the middle of the drawing room, still in her coat and hat, holding onto her parcels. Cynthia made her sit down, and then she told her. Nancy sat rigid, with just the hint of a smile quivering on her face. "You must come home with me, Granny, at least for tonight, until the house is aired out." "No, dear. I have a lot to do before the new housekeeper comes. She'll be here first thing Monday morning, and I must have her room ready with the new curtains hung." Cynthia drove Katie into Bramhall to her school friend's house again and was back in time to see Miss Thorpe's body being transferred into the police van. She stayed with Nancy that night and slept in the room next to Nancy's. The house was icy cold with all the windows open, but by morning the smell of gas was barely discernible, and Cynthia had slept peacefully, strangely comforted in that house of death by the presence of her mother-in-law, the woman who had given birth to Christopher and named him. They could find no one to take Miss Thorpe's belongings. There was no next of kin, and her one reference turned out to be fraudulent. Someone she'd met in a pub, apparently, and who had agreed to do her a good turn. So Cynthia packed up her things and took them to the Salvation Army in Cheadle-Hume. The post-mortem revealed that she'd had a cancer. "Eminently treatable," the forensic specialist said. A sad note to end on, and one that raises the question of all those single women and widows in service, reliant on their employers. Nameless, faceless women working their lives away for someone else's benefit. In my next podcast, I'll have more to say on this topic. When you read Mad Hatter, you will note that the book is dedicated to those very women. Thank you for listening. Mad Hatter is available in paperback and as an ebook from Guernica Editions. The audiobook is at audible.com, where you can hear a 5-minute sample reading. And for information on all my books, see my website, amandahale.com. My work is also available through Canadian libraries and at the unavoidable Amazon.